dress.
During the jury's lunch hour, hammering was heard from behind the stage depot and not 90 paces from the scene of the crime. This was the gallows going up. The work was supervised by the town's best carpenter, whose name, appropriately enough, was Mr. John House. Big snow was coming, and the road to Fort Pierre would be impassable, perhaps for a week, perhaps for the entire winter. There were no plans to jug Truesdale in the local calaboose till spring. There was no economy in that.
"Nothing to build in a gallows," House told folks who came to watch. "A child could build one of these."
He told how a lever-operated beam would run beneath the trap door, and how it would be axle-greased to make sure there wouldn't be any last-minute holdups.
"If you have to do a thing like this, you want to do it right the first time," House said.
In the afternoon, George Andrews put Truesdale on the stand. This occasioned some hissing from the spectators, which Judge Mizell gaveled down, promising to clear the courtroom if folks couldn't behave themselves.
"Did you enter the Chuckaluck Saloon on the day in question?" Andrews asked when order had been restored.
"I guess so," Truesdale said. "Otherwise I wouldn't be here." There was some laughter at that, which Mizell also gaveled down, although he was smiling himself and did not issue a second admonition.
"Did you order two drinks?"
"Yes, sir, I did. Two was all I had money for."
"But you got another dollar right quick, didn't you, you hound?" Abel Hines shouted.
Mizell pointed his gavel first at Hines, then at Sheriff Barkley, sitting in the front row.
"Sheriff, escort that man out and charge him with disorderly conduct, if you please."
Barkley escorted Hines out, but did not charge him with disorderly conduct.
He asked what had gotten into him instead. "I'm sorry, Otis," Hines said. "It was seeing him sitting there with his bare face hanging out."
"You go on down street and see if John House needs some help with his work," Barkley said. "Don't come back in here until this mess is over."
"He's got all the help he needs, and it's snowing hard now."
"You won't blow away. Go on." Meanwhile, Truesdale continued to testify. No, he hadn't left the Chuckaluck wearing his hat, but hadn't realized it until he got to his place. By then, he said, he was too tired to walk all the way back to town in search of it. Besides, it was dark. Mizell broke in. "Are you asking this court to believe you walked 4 miles without realizing you weren't wearing your damn hat?"
"I guess since I wear it all the time, I just figured it must be there," Truesdale said.
This elicited another gust of laughter. Barkley came back in and took his place next to Dave Fisher.
"What are they laughing at?"
"Dummy don't need a hangman," Fisher said. "He's tying the knot all by himself. I guess it shouldn't be funny, but it's pretty comical just the same."
"Did you encounter Rebecca Klein in that alley?" George Andrews asked in a loud voice.
With every eye on him, he had discovered a heretofore hidden flair for the dramatic.
"Did you encounter her and steal her birthday dollar?"
"No, sir,"
Truesdale said.
"Did you kill her?"
"No, sir. I didn't even know who she was."
Mr. Klein rose from his seat and shouted, "You lying son of a bitch!"
"I ain't lying," Truesdale said.
And that was when Sheriff Barkley believed him.
"I have no further questions," George Andrews said and walked back to his seat.
Truesdale started to get up, but Mizell told him to sit still and answer a few more questions. "Do you continue to contend, Mr. Truesdale, that someone stole your hat while you were drinking in the Chuckaluck, and that someone put it on and went into the alley and killed Rebecca Klein and left it there to implicate you?" Truesdale was silent.
"Answer the question, Mr. Truesdale."
"Sir, I don't know what implicate means."
"Do you expect us to believe someone framed you for this heinous murder?"
Truesdale considered, twisting his hands together. At last he said,
"Maybe somebody took it by mistake and throwed it away."
Mizell looked out at the rapt gallery.
"Did anyone here take Mr. Truesdale's hat by mistake?"
There was silence except for the wind. It was picking up. The snow was no longer flurries. The first big storm of winter had arrived. That was the one townsfolk called the wolf winter because the wolves came down from the Black Hills in packs to hunt for garbage. I have no more questions, Mizell said, and due to the weather, we're going to dispense with any closing statements. The jury will retire to consider a verdict. You have three choices, gentlemen: innocent, manslaughter, or murder in the first degree.
Girl slaughter, more like it, someone remarked.
Sheriff Barkley and Dave Fisher retired to the Chuckaluck. Abel Hines joined them, brushing snow from the shoulders of his coat. Dale Girard served them schooners of beer on the house.
Mizell might not have had no more questions, Barkley said, but I got one. Never mind the hat. If Truesdale killed her, how come we never found that silver dollar?
Because he got scared and threw it away, Hines said.
I don't think so. He's too bones stupid. If he'd had that dollar, he'd have gone back to the Chuckaluck and drunk it up.
What are you saying, Dave asked. Do you think he's innocent?
I'm saying I wish we'd found that cartwheel.
Maybe he lost it out a hole in his pocket.
He didn't have any holes in his pockets, Barkley said. Only one in his boot, and it wasn't big enough for a silver dollar to get through.
He drank some of his beer. The wind gusted, and tumbleweeds blew up Main Street looking like ghostly brains in the snow. The jury took an hour and a half.
We voted to hang him on the first ballot, Kelton Fisher said later, but we wanted it to look decent.
Mizell asked Truesdale if he had anything to say before sentence was passed.
I can't think of nothing, Truesdale said. Just, I never killed that girl.
The storm blew for 3 days. John House asked Barkley how much he reckoned Truesdale weighed, and Barkley said he guessed the man went around 140. House made a dummy out of burlap sacks and filled it with stones, weighing it on the hostelry scales until the needle stood pat on 140. Then he hung the dummy while half the town stood around in the snowdrifts and watched. The trial run went all right. On the night before the execution, the weather cleared. Sheriff Barkley told Truesdale he could have anything he wanted for dinner. Truesdale asked for steak and eggs, with home fries on the side soaked in gravy. Barkley bought it out of his own pocket and sat at his desk cleaning his fingernails and listening to the steady clink of Truesdale's knife and fork on the china plate. When it stopped, he went in. Truesdale was sitting on his bunk. His plate was so clean, Barkley figured he must have lapped up the last of the gravy like a dog. He was crying.
"Something just come to me," Truesdale said.
"What's that, Jim?"
"If they hang me tomorrow morning, I'll go into my grave with steak and eggs still in my belly. It won't have no chance to work through."
For a moment, Barkley said nothing. He was horrified, not by the image, but because Truesdale had thought of it. And then he said, "Wipe your nose." Truesdale wiped it. "Now listen to me, Jim, because this is your last chance. You were in that bar in the middle of the afternoon. Not many people in there then. Isn't that right?"
"I guess it is."
"Then who took your hat?
Close your eyes. Think back. See it."
Truesdale closed his eyes. Barkley waited. At last, Truesdale opened his eyes, which were red from crying.
"I can't even remember was I wearing it."
Barkley sighed. "Give me your plate, and mind that knife." Truesdale handed the plate through the bars with the knife and fork laid on it and said he wished he could have some beer. Barkley thought it over, then put on his heavy coat and Stetson and walked down to the Chuckaluck, where he got a small pail of beer from Dale Girard. Undertaker Hines was just finishing a glass of wine. He followed Barkley out into the wind and cold.
"Big day tomorrow," Barkley said.
"There hadn't been a hanging here in 10 years. And with luck, there won't be another for 10 more. I'll be gone out of the job by then. I wish I was now." Hines looked at him.
"You really don't think he killed her?"
"If he didn't," Barkley said, "whoever did is still walking around." The hanging was at 9 o'clock the next morning. The day was windy and bitterly cold, but most of the town turned out to watch. Pastor Ray Rowell stood on the scaffold next to John House. Both of them were shivering in spite of their coats and scarves. The pages of Pastor Rowell's Bible fluttered. Tucked into House's belt, also fluttering, was a hood of homespun cloth dyed black. Barkley led Truesdale, his hands cuffed behind his back, to the gallows. Truesdale was all right until he got to the steps. Then he began to buck and cry.
"Don't do this," he said. "Please don't do this to me. Please don't hurt me. Please don't kill me."
He was strong for a little man, and Barkley motioned Dave Fisher to come and lend a hand. Together they muscled Truesdale, twisting and ducking and pushing, up the 12 wooden steps. Once he bucked so hard, all three of them almost fell off, and arms reached up to catch them if they did.
"Quit that and die like a man," someone shouted.
When they reached the platform, Truesdale was momentarily quiet, but when Pastor Rouse commenced Psalm 51, he began to scream.
"Like a woman with her tit caught in the ringer," someone said later in the chuckaluck.
"Have mercy on me, O God, after thy great goodness," Rouse read, raising his voice to be heard over the condemned man's shrieks to be let off. "According to the multitude of thy mercies, do away with mine offenses." When Truesdale saw House take the black hood out of his belt, he began to pant like a dog. He shook his head from side to side, trying to dodge the hood. His hair flew. House followed each jerk patiently, like a man who means to bridle a skittish horse.
"Let me look at the mountains," Truesdale bellowed.
Runners of snot hung from his nostrils.
"I'll be good if you let me look at the mountains one more time."
But House only jammed the hood over Truesdale's head and pulled it down to his shaking shoulders. Pastor Rouse was droning on, and Truesdale tried to run off the trap door. Barkley and Dave Fisher pushed him back onto it. Down below, someone cried, "Ride 'em, cowboy!" "Say amen," Barkley told Pastor Rouse. "For Christ's sake, say amen."
"Amen,"
Pastor Rouse said, and stepped back, closing his Bible with a clap. Barkley nodded to House. House pulled the lever. The greased beam retracted and the trap dropped. So did Truesdale. There was a crack when his neck broke. His legs drew up almost to his chin, then fell back limp. Yellow drops stained the snow under his feet.
"There, you bastard!" Rebecca Klein's father shouted. "Died pissing like a dog on a fire plug. Welcome to hell!"
A few people clapped. The spectators stayed until Truesdale's corpse, still wearing the black hood, was laid in the same hurry-up wagon he'd ridden to town in. Then they dispersed. Barkley went back to the jail and sat in the cell Truesdale had occupied. He sat there for 10 minutes. It was cold enough to see his breath. He knew what he was waiting for, and eventually it came. He picked up the small bucket that had held Truesdale's last drink of beer and vomited. Then he went into his office and stoked up the stove. He was still there 8 hours later trying to read a book when Abel Hines came in. He said, "You need to come down to the funeral parlor, Otis. There's something I want to show you."
"What?"
"No, you'll want to see it for yourself." They walked down to the Hines funeral parlor and mortuary. In the back room, Truesdale lay naked on a cooling board. There was a smell of chemicals and shit.
"They load their pants when they die that way," Hines said. "Even men who go to it with their heads up, they can't help it.
The sphincter, let's go."
"And?" "Step over here.
I figure a man in your job has seen worse than a pair of shitty drawers." They lay on the floor, mostly turned inside out. Something gleamed in the mess. Barkley leaned closer and saw it was a silver dollar. He reached down and plucked it out of the crap.
"I don't understand it," Hines said. "Son of a bitch was locked up almost a month."
There was a chair in the corner. Barkley sat down in it so heavily he made a little woof sound. He must have swallowed it the first time when he saw our lanterns coming. And every time it came out, he cleaned it off and swallowed it again. The two men stared at each other.
"You believed them," Hines said at last.
"Fool that I am, I did."
"Maybe that says more about you than it does about him."
He went on saying he was innocent right to the end. He'll most likely stand at the throne of God, saying the same thing.
Yes, Hines said.
I don't understand. He was going to hang. Either way, he was going to hang. Do you understand it?
I don't even understand why the sun comes up. What are you going to do with that cartwheel? Give it back to the girl's mother and father? Might be better if you didn't, because...
Hines shrugged. Because the Kleins knew all along. Everyone in town knew all along. He was the only one that hadn't known. Fool that he was.
I don't know what I'm going to do with it, he said.
The wind gusted, bringing the sound of singing. It was coming from the church. It was the doxology.
Thinking of Elmore Leonard. I have written poetry since I was 12 and fell in love for the first time, 7th grade. Since then I've written hundreds of poems, usually scribbled on scraps of paper or in half-used notebooks, and have published less than half a dozen of them. Most are stowed in various drawers, God knows where, I don't. There's a reason for this. I'm not much of a poet. That's not lowballing, just the truth. When I do manage something I like, it's mostly by accident. The rationale for including this piece of work is that it, like the other poem in this collection, is narrative rather than lyric. The first draft, long lost, like my original take on the story that became Mile 81, was written in college and very much under the influence of Robert Browning's dramatic monologues, most notably My Last Duchess. Another Browning poem, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came, became the basis of a series of books many of my constant readers know quite well. If you've read Browning, you may hear his voice rather than mine. If not, that's fine. It's basically a story, like any other, which means it's to be enjoyed rather than deconstructed. A friend of mine named Jimmy Smith read that lost first draft at a University of Maine poetry hour one Tuesday afternoon in 1968 or 69, and it was well received. Why not? He gave it his all, really belting it out. And people are captivated by a good story, whether it's in verses or paragraphs. This was a pretty good one, especially given the format, which allowed me to strip away all the prosy exposition. In the fall of 2008, I got to thinking about Jimmy's reading, and since I was between projects, I decided to try recreating the poem. This is the result. How much resemblance it bears to the original, I really can't say. Jimmy, I hope you're out there someplace and come across this. You rocked the house that day.
The Bone Church, read by Cotter Smith.
If you want to hear, buy me another drink. Ah, this is slop, but never mind. What isn't? There were 32 of us went into that green sore. 30 days in the green, and only 3 who rose above it. 3 rose above the green. 3 made it to the top. Manning and Revoir and me. And what does that book say, the famous one? Only I am left to tell you. I'll die of the drink in bed, as many obsessed poor sons do. And do I mourn Manning? Balls. It was his money put us there. His will that drove us on, death by death. But did he die in bed? Not that one. I saw to it. Now he worships in that bone church forever. Life is grand. What slop is this? Still, buy me another. Do, buy me 2. I'll talk for whiskey. If you want me to shut up, switch me to champagne. Talk is cheap. Silence is dear, my dear. What was I saying? 29 dead on the march, and 1 a woman. fine tits she had, and an ass like an English saddle. We found her face down one morning, as dead as the fire she lay in, and ash baby smoked at the cheeks and throat. Never burnt. That fire must have been cold when she went in. She talked the whole voyage and died without a sound. What's better than being human? Do you say so? No? Then balls to you and your mother, too. If she'd had a pair, she'd have been a fucking king. Anthropologist. Ah, so she said. Didn't look like no anthropologist when we pulled her out of the ashes with char on her cheeks and the whites of her eyes dusted gray with soot. Not a mark on her otherwise. Doran said it might have been a stroke, and he was as close to a doctor as we had, that poxy bastard. For the love of God, bring whiskey! For life's a trudge without it. The green did him down, day by day. Carson died of a stick in his boot. His foot swole up, and when we cut away the boot leather, his toesies were as black as the squid's ink that drove Manning's heart. Reston and Polgoy, they were stung by spiders big as your fist. Ackerman bit by a snake what dropped out of a tree where it hung like a lady's fur stole draped on a branch. Bit its poison into Ackerman's nose. How strong a throw, you ask? Try this. He ripped his own snoot clean off. Yes! Tore it away like a rotten peach off a branch and died spitin' his own dying face. God damn life! I say, if you can't laugh, you might as well laugh anyway. That's my goddamn attitude, and I stick by it. This ain't a sad world unless you're sane. Now, where was I? Javier fell off a plank bridge. And when we hauled him out, he couldn't breathe, so Dorrance tried to kiss him back to life and sucked from his throat a leech as big as a hothouse tomato. It popped free like a cork from a bottle and split between them, sprayed both with the claret we live on. For we're all alcoholics that way, if you see my figure. And when the Spaniard died, raving, Manning said the leeches had gone to his brain. As for me, I hold no opinion on that. All I know is that Javi's eyes wouldn't stay shut, but went on, bulging in and out, even after he were an hour cold. Something hungry there, all right. Ah, yes, there was. And all the while the macaws screamed at the monkeys, and the monkeys screamed at the macaws, and both screamed for the blue sky they couldn't see, for it was buried in the goddamn green. Is this whiskey or diarrhea in a glass? There was one of those suckers in the Frenchie's pants. Did I tell you? You know what that one ate, don't you? It was Dorrance himself went next. We were climbing by then, but still in the green. He fell in a gorge, and we could hear the snap. Broke his neck. 26 years of age, engaged to be married, case closed. Oh, ain't life grand? Life's a sucker in the throat. Life's the gorge. We all fall in. It's a soup. And we all end up vegetables. Ain't I philosophical? Never mind. It's too late to count the dead, and I'm too drunk. In the end, we got there. Just say that. Climbed the high path out of all that sizzling green after we buried Rostoy, Timmons, the Texan, I forget his name, and Dorrance and a couple of the other ones. In the end, most went down of some fever that boiled their skin and turned it green. At the end, it was only Manning, Revoir, and me. We caught the fever, too, but killed it before it killed us. Only I ain't never really got better. Now whiskey's my quinine, what I take for the shakes. So, buy me another before I forget my manners and cut your fucking throat. Might even drink what comes out, so be wise, sonny, and trot it over, goddamn you. There was a road we came to. Even Manning agreed it was. And wide enough for elephants if the ivory hunters hadn't picked clean the jungles and the plains beyond them, back when gas was still a nickel. It bore up that road, and we bore up with it on tilted slabs of stone, a million years jounced free of Mother Earth, leaping one to another like frogs in the sun. Revoir, still burning with a fever, and me, ah, I was light, Like milkweed gauze on a breeze, you know. I saw it all. My mind was as clear then as clean water. For I was as young then as horrid now. Yes, I see how you look at me, but you needn't frown so, for it's your own future you see on this side of table. We climbed above the birds, and there was the end. A stone tongue poked straight into the sky. Manning broke into a run, and we ran after. Revoir, trotting a right smart, sick as he was. But he wasn't sick long. We looked down and saw what we saw. Manning flushed red at the sight, and why not, for greed's a fever, too. He grabbed me by the rag that was once my shirt and asked, were it just a dream, when I said I saw what he saw. He turned to Revoir. But before Revoir could say aye or nay, we heard thunder coming up from the green roof we'd left behind. Like a storm turned upside down, or say like all of the earth had caught the fever that stalked us and was sick in its bowels. I asked Manning what he heard, and Manning said nothing. He was hypnotized by that cleft, looking down 1,000 feet of ancient air into the church below, 1,000,000 years worth of bone and tusk, a whited sepulcher of eternity, a fresh bit of prong such as you'd see if hell burned dry to the slag of its cauldron. You expected to see bodies impaled on the ancient thorns of that sunny tomb. There were none. But the thunder was coming, rolling up from the ground instead of down from the sky. The stones shook beneath our heels as they burst free of the green that took so many of us. Rostoy with his mouth harp, Dorrance who sang along, the anthropologist with the ass like an English saddle, 26 others. They arrived, those gaunt ghosts, and shook the green roof from their feet. And came in a shuddering wave, elephants, stampeding from the green cradle of time. Towering among them, believe what you want, were mammoths from the dead age when man was not. Their tusks in corkscrews and their eyes as red as the whips of sorrow. Wrapped around their wrinkled legs were jungle vines. One come, yes, with a flower stuck in a fold of his chest hide like a boutonniere. Revoir screamed and put his hand over his eyes. Manning said, I don't see that. He sounded like a man explaining to a fucking traffic cop. I pulled him aside and we three stumbled into a stony cunt near the edge. From there, we watched them roll. A tide in the face of reality that made you wish for blindness and glad for sight. They went past us, never slowing, the ones behind driving the ones before, and over they went, trumpeting their way to suicide. Crashing into the bones of their oblivion a dusty mile below. Hours it went on, that endless convention of tumbling death. Trumpets all the way down, a brass orchestra diminishing. The dust and the smell of their shit near choked us. And in the end, Revoir ran mad. Stood up, whether to pelt away or to join him, I don't never knew which, but join him he did, head first. And down with his boot heels in the sky and all the nailheads winking. One arm waved, the other, one of those giant flat feet tore it off his body and the arm followed after. Fingers waving, bye-bye, and bye-bye, and so long, boys. Har! I leaned out to see him go, and it was a sight to remember. How he sprayed in pinwheels and hung in the air after he was gone, then turned pink, and floated away on a breeze that smelled of rotten carnations. His bones are with the others now, and where's my drink? But hear this, you idiot. The only new bones were his. You mark what I say? Then listen again, damn you. His, but no others. Nothing down there after the last of the giants had passed us but for the bone church, which was as it was, with one blot of red, and that was Revoir. For that was a stampede of ghosts, or memories, and who's to say they're not the same? Manning got up trembling, said our fortunes were made as if he didn't already have one. And what about what you just saw, I asked. Would you bring others to see such a holy place? Why, next thing you know, the Pope himself would be pissing his holy water over the side. But Manning only shook his head and grinned and held up hands without a speck of dust on him. Although not a minute passed, we'd been choking on it by the bale and coated with it from top to toe. He said it was hallucination we'd seen, brought on by fever and stink water. Said again that our fortunes were made, and laughed. The bastard. That laugh was his undoing. I saw that he was mad, or I was, and one of us would have to die. You know which one it was since I sit here before you, drunk, with hair that once was black hanging in my eyes. He said, "Don't you see, you fool," and said no more, for the rest was just a scream. Balls to him, and balls to your grinning face. I don't remember how I got back. It's a dream of green with brown faces in it, then a dream of blue with white faces in it, and now I wake at night in this city where not one man in 10 dreams of what lies beyond his life. For the eyes they used to dream with are shut, as Manning's were until the end, when not all the bank accounts in hell or Switzerland, they may be the same, could save 'em. I wake with my liver bellowing, and in the dark I hear the lumbering thunder of those great ghosts rising out of the green roof, like a storm set loose to harrow the earth. And I smell the dust and the shit. And when the horde breaks free into the sky of their undoing, I see the ancient fans of their ears and the hooks of their tusks. I see their eyes and their eyes and their eyes. There's more to life than this. There are maps inside your maps. It's still there, the Bone Church. And I'd like to go back and find it again so I could throw myself over and be done this wretched comedy. Now turn away your sheep's face before I turn it away for you. Ah, reality's a dirty place with no religion in it. So buy me a drink, goddamn you. We'll toast elephants that never were.
For Jimmy Smith. Morality is a slippery subject. If I didn't know that as a boy, I found out when I went to college. I attended the University of Maine on a slapped-together financial scaffolding of small scholarships, government loans, and summer jobs. During the school year, I worked the dish line in West Commons. The money never stretched far enough. My single mother, who was working as head housekeeper in a mental institution called Pineland Training Center, sent me $12 a week, which helped a little. After Mom died, I found out from one of her sisters that she had managed it by giving up her monthly beauty parlor visit and economizing on groceries. She also skipped lunch every Tuesday and Thursday. Once I moved off campus and away from West Commons, I sometimes supplemented my own diet by shoplifting steaks or packages of hamburger from the local supermarket. You had to do it on Fridays when the store was really busy. I once tried for a chicken, but it was too fucking big to go under my coat. Word got around that I would write papers for students who found themselves in a bind. I had a sliding scale for this service. If a student got an A, my fee was $20. I got $10 for a B. A grade of C was a wash, and no money changed hands. For a D or an F, I promised my client that I would pay him or her $20. I made sure I would never have to pay because I couldn't afford it. And I was sly. It embarrasses me to say that, but it's the truth. I wouldn't take on a project unless the student in need could provide at least one paper he or she had written so I could copy the style. I didn't need to do this a lot, thank God, but when I had to, when I was broke and simply couldn't live without a burger and fries at the Bears Den in Memorial Union, I did. Then, when I was a junior, I discovered that I had a fairly rare blood type, A negative, roughly 6% of the population. There was a clinic in Bangor that would pay $25 per pint for A neg. I thought that an excellent deal. Every 2 months or so, I drove my battered old station wagon up Route 2 from Orono, or hitchhiked when it was broke down, a frequent occurrence, and rolled up my sleeve. There was far less paperwork in those pre-AIDS years, and when your pint was in the bag, you had your choice of a small glass of orange juice or a small knock of whiskey. Being an alcoholic in training, even then, I always opted for the whiskey. Headed back to school after one of these donations, it occurred to me that if whoring is selling yourself for money, then I was a whore. Writing English essays and sociology term papers was also whoring. I had been raised mainstream Methodist, and I had a clear fix on right and wrong, but there it was. I had become a whore, only peddling my blood and writing skills instead of my ass. That realization raised questions of morality that still engage me to this day. It's a rubbery concept, isn't it? Uniquely stretchable. But if you stretch anything too far, it will tear. Nowadays, I give my blood instead of selling it, but it occurred to me then, and still seems true to me now. Under the right circumstances, anyone might sell anything and live to regret it.
Morality. Read by Mayor Winningham. One. Chad knew something was up as soon as he walked in. Nora was home already. Her hours were from 11 to 5, 6 days a week. The way it usually worked, he got home from school at 4 and had dinner on when she came in around 6. She was sitting on the fire escape where he went to smoke, and she had some paperwork in her hands. He looked at the refrigerator and saw that the email printout was gone from beneath the magnet that had been holding it in place for almost 4 months. "Hey, you," she said, "come on out here." She paused. "Bring your butts if you want." He was down to just a pack a week, but that didn't make her like his habit any better. The health issue was part of it, but the expense was an even bigger part. Every cigarette was 40 cents up in smoke. He climbed out the window and sat down beside her. She had changed into jeans and one of her old blouses, so she had been home for a while. Stranger and stranger. They looked out over their little bit of the city for a while without speaking. He kissed her, and she smiled in an absent way. She had the agent's email. She also had the file folder with "the red and the black" written on it in big capitals. His little joke, but not so funny. The file contained their financial stuff. Bank and credit card statements, utility bills, insurance premiums, and the bottom line was all red. It was an American story these days, just not enough. 2 years ago, they'd talked about having a kid. What they talked about now was getting out from under, and maybe enough ahead to leave the city without a bunch of creditors snapping at their heels. Move north to New England. But not yet. At least here they were working. "How was school?" she asked. "Fine." Actually, the job was a plum. But after Anita Biderman got back from maternity leave, who knew? Probably not another job at PS 321. He was high on the list of subs, but that didn't mean anything if the regular teaching roster was all present and accounted for. Sometimes, lying in bed and waiting for sleep to overtake him, he thought of the little boy in the D.H. Lawrence story, who rode his rocking horse crying, "There must be more money." "You're home early," he said. "Don't tell me when he died." She looked startled, then smiled. But they had been together for 10 years, married for the last 6, and Chad knew when something was wrong. "Nora?" "He sent me home early to think. I've got a lot to think about. I'm..." She shook her head. He took her by the shoulder and turned her to him. "You're what, Nori? Is everything okay? Go on, light up, smoking lamps lit. Tell me what's going on." She had been cut off from the staff of Congress Memorial Hospital 2 years ago during a reorganization. Luckily for the Chad and Nora Corporation, she had landed on her feet. Getting the home nursing job had been something of a coup. One patient, a retired minister recovering from a stroke, 36 hours a week, very decent wages. She made more than he did, and by a good bit. The two incomes were almost enough to live on, at least until Anita Biderman came back.
First, let's talk about this. She held up the agent's email. How sure are you? That I can do the work? Pretty sure. Almost positive. I mean, if I had the time. About the rest, he shrugged. It's right there in black and white. No guarantees. With the hiring freeze currently in effect in the city's schools, subbing was the best Chad could do. He was on every list in the system, but there was no full-time position teaching fourth or fifth grade in his immediate future. Nor would the money be much better even if such a position opened up, just more reliable. As a sub, he sometimes spent weeks on the bench. Out of desperation and a need to fill up the empty hours when Nora was tending to the Reverend Winston, Chad had started a book he called Living with the Animals, The Life of a Substitute Teacher in Four City Schools. Words did not come easily to him, and on some days they did not come at all. But by the time he was called in to St. Xavier to teach second grade, Mr. Cardelli had broken a leg in a car accident, he had finished three chapters. Nora received the pages with a troubled smile. No woman wants the job of telling the man in her life that he's been wasting his time. He hadn't been. The stories he told of the substitute teaching life were sweet, funny, and often moving, much more interesting than anything she'd heard over dinner or while they were lying in bed together. He finally found an agent who would at least look at the 80 pages he had managed to wring out of his old and limping Dell laptop. The agent's name had a circusy feel, Edward Ringling. His response to Chad's pages was long on praise and short on promise. I might be able to get you a book contract based on this and an outline of the rest, Ringling had written, but it would be a very small contract, likely a good deal less than you currently make as a teacher. What I suggest is that you finish another 7 or 8 chapters, possibly even the whole book. Then I might be able to take it to auction and get you a much better deal. It made sense, Chad supposed, if you were overseeing the literary world from a comfy office in Manhattan. Not so much if you were hopscotching all over the boroughs, teaching a week here and 3 days there, trying to keep ahead of the bills. Ringling's letter had come in May. Now it was September, and although Chad had had a relatively good summer teaching, God bless the dummies, he sometimes thought, he hadn't added a single page to the manuscript. It wasn't laziness. Teaching, even when it was just subbing, was like having a pair of jumper cables attached to some critical part of your brain. How long would it take to finish it, Nora asked, if you were writing full time? He drew out his cigarettes and lit one. He felt a strong urge to give an over-optimistic answer, but overcame it. Whatever was going on with her, she deserved the truth. 8 months, at least. And how much money do you think it would mean if Mr. Ringling held an auction? On this, Chad had done his homework. I guess the advance could be in the neighborhood of $100,000. A fresh start in Vermont, that was the plan. That was what they talked about in bed. A small town, maybe up in the Northeast Kingdom. She could catch on at the local hospital or get another private. He could land a full-time teaching position, or just maybe write another book. Nora, what's this about? I'm afraid to tell you, she said, but I will. Crazy or not, I will. Because the number Winnie mentioned was bigger than $100,000. Only one thing. I'm not quitting my job. He said I could keep it no matter what we decided, and we need that job. He reached for the aluminum ashtray he kept tucked under the windowsill and butted his cigarette in it. Then he took her hand. Tell me. He listened with amazement, but not disbelief. He sort of wished he could disbelieve it, but he did not. What had she actually known about Reverend George Winston? That he was a lifelong bachelor? That 3 years into his retirement from the Second Presbyterian Church of Park Slope, where he was still listed on the church slate as pastor emeritus, he had suffered a stroke which had left him partially paralyzed on the right side? Not much more. He could now walk to the bathroom, and on good days to his front porch rocker, with the help of a plastic brace that kept his bad knee from buckling. And he could talk understandably again, although he still sometimes suffered from what Nora called sleepy tongue. Nora had previous experience with stroke victims. It was what had clinched the job, and she had a large appreciation for how far he had come in a short time. In addition to such nursely duties as giving him his pills and monitoring his blood pressure, she worked as a physical therapist. She was also a speech therapist, a masseuse, and occasionally, when he had letters to write, a secretary. She ran errands and sometimes read to him, and she wasn't above light housekeeping on days when Mrs. Granger did not come in. On those days, she made sandwiches or omelets for lunch, and she supposed it was over those lunches that he had drawn out the details of her own life, and done it without Nora ever realizing what was going on. "The one thing I remember saying," she told Chad, and probably only because he mentioned it today, "was that we weren't living in abject poverty or even in discomfort, that it was the fear of those things that got me down." Chad smiled at that. "You and me both." This morning, Winnie had refused both the sponge bath and the massage. Instead, he had asked her to put on his brace and help him into his study, which was a relatively long walk for him, certainly farther than the porch rocker. He made it and fell into the chair behind his desk, red-faced and panting. He drained a glass of orange juice she gave him at a single go. "Thank you, Nora. I want to talk to you now, very seriously." He must have seen her apprehension, because he smiled and made a waving-off gesture. "It's not about your job. You'll have that no matter what, if you want it. If not, I'll see that you have a reference that can't be beat." "Nice of him, but there weren't many jobs like this around." "You're making me nervous, Winnie," she said. "Nora, how would you like to make $200,000? She gawked at him. On either side, high shelves of smart books frowned down. The noises from the street were muffled. They might have been in another country, a quieter country than Brooklyn. "If you think this is about sex, it occurred to me that you might. I assure you it is not. At least I don't think so. If one looks below the surface and if one has read Freud, I suppose any aberrant act may be said to have a sexual basis. I don't know myself. I haven't studied Freud since seminary, and even there my reading was cursory. Freud offended me. He seemed to feel that any suggestion of depth in human nature was an illusion. He seemed to be saying, what you think is a pool is a puddle. I beg to differ. Human nature has no bottom. It is as deep and mysterious as the mind of God." "With all respect, I'm not sure I believe in God. And I'm not sure this is a proposal I want to hear." "But if you don't listen, you won't know. And you'll always wonder." She was unsure what to do or say. What she thought was, that desk he's sitting behind must have cost thousands. It was the first time she had really thought of him in connection with money. "What I'm offering should be enough to pay off all the outstanding bills, enough to enable your husband to finish his book. Enough, perhaps, to start a new life in, was it Vermont?"
"Yes."
"Cash, Nora. No need to get the IRS involved either." He had long features and white woolly hair, a sheep-like face she had always thought it before today. "Cash causes no problems if it's fed slowly into the stream of one's accounts. Also, once your husband's book is sold and you're established in New England, we need never see each other again." He paused. "Although we could. That part would be up to you. And please relax. You're sitting bolt upright." It was the thought of $200,000 that kept her in the room. $200,000 in cash. She found she could actually see it, bills stuffed into a padded manila envelope, or perhaps it would take two envelopes to hold that much. "Let me talk for a bit," he said. "I haven't really done much of that, have I? Mostly I've listened." "It's your turn to listen now, Nora. Will you do that?"
"I suppose."
She was very curious. She supposed anybody would be.
"Who do you want me to kill?"
It was a joke, but as soon as it came out of her mouth, she was afraid it might be true. Because it didn't sound like a joke. No more than the eyes in his long sheep's face looked like sheep's eyes. To her relief, Winnie laughed. Then he said, "Not murder, my dear. We won't need to go that far." He talked then, as he never had before, to anyone, probably.
I grew up in a wealthy home on Long Island. My father was successful in the stock market. He survived my mother by only 5 years, and when he passed on, I inherited a great deal of money, mostly in bonds and solid stocks. Over the years since, I have converted a small percentage of that to cash, a bit at a time. Not a nest egg, because I've never needed one, but what I'd call a wish egg. It's in a Manhattan safe deposit box, and it's that cash that I'm offering you, Nora. It may actually be closer to $240,000, but we'll agree, shall we, not to quibble over a dollar here and a dollar there? My life has been one, I say it with neither pride nor shame, of unremarkable service. I have led my church in helping the poor, both in countries far from here and in this community. The AA drop-in center up the street was my idea, for instance, and it's helped hundreds of suffering alcoholics and addicts. I've comforted the sick and buried the dead. More cheerfully, I've presided over more than 1,000 weddings and inaugurated a scholarship fund that has sent many boys and girls to colleges they could not otherwise have afforded. I have only one regret. In all my years, I have never committed one of the sins about which I have spent a lifetime warning my various flocks. I am not a lustful man, and since I've never been married, I never had so much as the opportunity to commit adultery. I'm not gluttonous by nature, and although I like nice things, I've never been greedy or covetous. Why would I be, when my father left me $15 million? I've worked hard, keep my temper, envy no one, except perhaps Mother Teresa, and have little pride of possessions or position. I'm not claiming I'm without sin, not at all. Those who can say, and I suppose there are a few, that they have never sinned in deed or word, can hardly say they've never sinned in thought, can they? The church covers every loophole. We hold out heaven, then make people understand they have no hope of achieving it without our help. Because no one is without sin, and the wages of sin is death. I suppose this makes me sound like an unbeliever, but raised as I was, unbelief is as impossible for me as levitation. Yet I understand the cozening nature of the bargain, and the psychological tricks believers use to ensure the prosperity of those beliefs. The Pope's fancy hat was not conferred on him by God, but by men and women paying theological blackmail money. I can see you fidgeting, so I'll come to the point. I want to commit a major sin before I die. A sin not of thought or word, but of deed. This was on my mind, increasingly on my mind, before my stroke, but I thought it a frenzy that would pass. Now I see that it will not, because the idea has been with me more than ever during the last 3 years. But how great a sin can an old man stuck in a wheelchair commit, I asked myself. Then, listening to you talk about your husband's book and your financial situation, it occurred to me that I could sin by proxy. In fact, I could double my sin quotient, as it were, by making you my accessory. She spoke from a dry mouth. I believe in wrongdoing, Wenny, but I don't believe in sin. He smiled. It was a benevolent smile. Also unpleasant. Sheep's lips, wolf's teeth. That's fine. But sin believes in you. And do you know what doubles sin? No, I don't go to church. What doubles it is saying to yourself, I will do this because I know I can pray for forgiveness once it's done. To say to yourself that you can have your cake and eat it too. I want to know what being that deep in sin is like. I don't want to wallow. I want to dive in over my head. And take me with you, she said with real indignation. But you don't believe in sin, Nora. You just said so. From your standpoint, all I want is for you to get a little dirty. And risk arrest, I suppose. although the risk should be minor. For these things, I will pay you $200,000. Her face and hands felt numb, as if she had just come in from a long walk in the cold. She would not do it, of course. What she would do was walk out of this house and get some fresh air. She wouldn't quit, or at least not immediately, because she needed the job, but she would walk out. And if he fired her for deserting her post, let him. But first, she wanted to hear the rest. What is it you want me to do? Chad had lit another cigarette. What was it? She motioned with her fingers. Give me a drag on that. Nori, you haven't smoked a cigarette in five... Give me a drag, I said. He passed the cigarette to her. She dragged deep, coughed the smoke out, then told him the rest. She lay awake late into the night, sure he was sleeping, and why not? The decision had been made. She would tell Winnie no, and never mention the idea again. Decision made, sleep follows. Still, she wasn't entirely surprised when he turned to her and said, I can't stop thinking about it. Nor could Nora. I'd do it, you know, for us, if... Now they were face to face, inches apart, close enough to taste each other's breath. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, the hour of conspiracy if there ever was one, she thought. If? If I didn't think it would taint our lives. Some stains don't come out. It's a moot question, Nor. We've decided. You play Sarah Palin and tell him thanks but no thanks for that bridge to nowhere. I'll find a way to finish the book without his psycho idea of a grant in aid. When? On your next unpaid leave? I don't think so. It's decided. He's nuts. The end. He rolled away from her. Silence descended. Upstairs, Mrs. Reston, whose picture belonged in the dictionary next to insomnia, walked back and forth. Somewhere, maybe in deepest, darkest Gowanus, a siren wailed. 15 minutes went by before Chad spoke to the end table and the digital clock, which now read 217A. Also, we'd have to trust him for the money, and you can't trust a man whose one remaining ambition in life is to commit a sin. But I do trust him, she said. It's myself I don't trust. Go to sleep, Chad. This subject is closed. Right back at you, he said. The clock read 2:26 a when she said, It could be done. I'm sure of that much. I could change my hair color, wear a hat, dark glasses, of course, and there would have to be an escape route. Are you seriously? I don't know. I'd have to work almost 3 years to make $200,000, and after the government and the banks wet their beaks, there'd be next to nothing left. We know how that works. She was quiet for a minute, looking at the ceiling above which Mrs. Reston trod her slow miles. And what if you got hit by a car? What if I turned up with an ovarian cyst? Our coverage is okay. That's what everyone says, but what everyone knows is they fuck you at the drive-thru. With this, we could be sure. That's what I keep thinking about. Sure. $200,000 makes my financial hopes for the book seem kind of small, though, don't you think? Why even bother? Because this would be a one-time thing. And the book would be clean. Clean? You think this would make the book clean? He rolled over and faced her. Part of him had grown hard, so perhaps part of this was about sex. Who knew about such things? Who wanted to? Do you think I'll ever get another job like the one with Winnie? He said nothing to this, which was an answer in itself. And I'm not getting any younger. I'll be 36 in December. You'll take me to dinner for my birthday, and a week later I'll get my real present, a past due notice for the car loan payment. Are you blaming me for... No, I'm not even blaming the system. Blame is counterproductive. And I told Winnie the truth. I don't believe in sin. But I also don't want to go to jail. She felt tears growing in her eyes. I don't want to hurt anyone either. Especially not... You're not going to.
He started to turn over, but she grabbed his shoulder. If we did it, if I did it, we could never talk about it afterward, not one single time. No. She reached for him. In marriages, deals were sealed with more than a handshake. This they both knew. The clock said 2:58 a. Outside and below, a street sweeper went hushing by. He was drifting to sleep when she said, "Do you know anyone with a video camera? Because he wants... Charlie Green has one." After that, silence. Except for Mrs. Reston, still walking slowly back and forth above them. Mrs. Reston patiently walking off all those night miles. Then Nora fell asleep. Her mother had never been a churchgoer, but Nora had attended vacation Bible school every summer and enjoyed it. There were games and songs and flannel board stories. She found herself remembering one of the stories the next day in Winnie's study. "I wouldn't have to really hurt the, you know, the person to get the money," she asked him. "I want to be very clear about that." "No, but I expect to see blood flow. Let me be clear about that. I want you to use your fist, but a cut lip or a bloody nose will be quite sufficient." For the story, the teacher put a mountain on the flannel board, then Jesus, then the devil. The teacher said the devil had taken Jesus up on the mountain and showed him all the cities of the earth. "You can have everything in those cities," the devil said, "every treasure. All you have to do is fall down and worship me." But Jesus was a stand-up guy. Jesus had said thanks, but no thanks. "Sin," she mused, "that's what's on your mind. Sin for its own sake, deliberately planned and executed. Do you find the idea exciting?" "No," she said, looking up at the frowning bookshelves. Winnie let some time pass, then said, "Well, if I got caught, would I still get the money?" "If you lived up to your part of the agreement, and didn't implicate me, of course, you certainly would. And even if you were caught, the very worst to come of it would be probation. Plus court-ordered psychiatric evaluation," she said, "which I probably need for even considering this." Winnie said, "If you continue the way you are, dear, you'll need a marriage counselor at the very least. In my time in the ministry, I counseled many partners. And while money worries weren't always the root cause of their problems, that's what it was in most cases. And that's all it was." "Thank you for the benefit of your experience, Winnie." He said nothing to this. "You're crazy, you know." He still said nothing. She looked at the book some more. Most of them were on religion. Finally, she turned her eyes back to his. "If I do this and you fuck me, I'll make you sorry." He showed no discomfiture at her choice of language. "I'll honor my commitment. You may be sure of that. You speak almost perfectly now, not even a lisp unless you're tired." He shrugged. "Being with me has trained your ear. It's like learning to understand a new language, I suppose." She returned her eyes to the books. One of them was called The Problem of Good and Evil. Another was titled The Basis of Morality. It was a thick one. In the hall, an old regulator clock was ticking steadily. Finally, he said it again. "Well?" The regulator ticked. Without looking at him, she said, "If you say well again, I'll walk out of here." He didn't say well or anything else. She looked down at her hands, twisting in her lap. The most appalling thing? Part of her was still curious. Not about what he wanted, that cat was out of the bag, but about what she wanted. At last she looked up and gave her answer. "Excellent," he said. With the decision made, neither Chad nor Nora wanted the actual act hanging over their heads. It cast too big a shadow. They chose Forest Park in Queens. Chad borrowed Charlie Green's video camera and learned how to use it.
They went to the park twice beforehand, on rainy days when it was mostly empty, and Chad videotaped the area they decided on. They had a lot of sex during that period. Nervous sex, fumbling sex, but usually good sex. Hot, at least. Nora found her other major appetites dwindling. In the 10 days between her agreement and the morning when she executed her part of the bargain, she lost 9 pounds. Chad said she was starting to look like a teenager again. On a sunny day in early October, Chad parked their old Ford on Jewel Avenue. Nora sat beside him, her hair dyed red and hanging to her shoulders, looking very un-Nora-like in a long skirt and an ugly brown smock top. She was wearing sunglasses and a Mets cap. She seemed calm enough, but when he reached out to touch her, she twitched away. Nora, come on. Have you got cab fare?
Yes.
And a bag to put the video cam in?
Yes, of course.
Then give me the car keys. I'll see you back at the apartment.
Are you sure you'll be able to drive? Because the reaction to something like this...
I'll be fine. Give me the keys. Wait here 15 minutes. If there's something wrong, if anything even feels wrong, I'll come back. If I don't, you go to the spot we picked out. Do you remember it?
Of course I remember it.
She smiled, showed her teeth and dimples at least. That's the spirit, she said, and was gone. It was an excruciatingly long 15 minutes, but Chad waited through every one of them. Kids wearing clamshell helmets pooted past on bikes. Women strolled in pairs, many with shopping bags. He saw an old lady laboriously crossing the avenue, and for one moment he thought it was Mrs. Reston, but when she passed by, he saw that it wasn't. This woman was much older than Mrs. Reston. When the 15 minutes were almost up, it occurred to him, in a sane and rational way, that he could put a stop to this by driving away. The extra ignition key was hidden beneath the spare tire. In the park, Nora would look around and not see him. She would be the one to take the cab back to Brooklyn. And when she got there, she would thank him. She would say, "You saved me from myself." After that, take a month off. No substitute teacher.